Hi, Pod People. It's that time of year when we ask you who may not depend on a local public radio station or just ignore their entreaties to pony up for On the Media's podcast. WNYC covers the cost, which ain't cheap. It takes a lot of hours, and we need you to pitch in. Text OTM to 25383, and you'll be sending $10 to WNYC. The donation will appear on your phone bill, messaging, and data rates apply. We've covered a lot of news this year. We went to Egypt, we outed the senators who secretly killed the Whistleblower Protection Act, and we even covered bias on public radio. Show us it matters to you by sending us $10 for the podcast. Text OTM to 25383. Seriously, it matters to us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, news broke that Dominique Strauss-Kahn resigned from his position as manager of the International Monetary Fund. The French politician said he needed to focus all his energy on fighting charges that he sexually assaulted a maid in his New York City hotel room. Unsurprisingly, the American media were all over the story. An identical uproar in France, however, may have marked a watershed moment in French media and society. Eleanor Beardsley is NPR's correspondent in Paris. Eleanor, welcome to OTM.
Great to be with you, Bob.
Now, this is a guy who had a reputation even before this alleged crime, but the reputation wasn't really widely circulated in the French media. Can you tell me why not?
Well, he had a reputation as, it's known as a dragueur here, someone who loves women, a womanizer, but there's sort of a charm to it. He's a very smart man, he's a very charming man, and he loves women. But I don't think people really knew the extent of his problem with it. There were hints of it. About 5 years ago, a book came out called Sexus Politicus that talked about politicians and their sex lives. And there was a whole chapter on Dominique Strauss-Kahn and how he goes really close to the border of harassment. But it was too sensitive. Nobody touched it. I was told today by a journalist, if someone had ever sued him or gone to court, then we would have reported on it. But it was just sort of seen as a private matter.
How much of this is an issue of insufficient media attention, and how much of it is an issue of a society that sets a kind of a low bar for personal comportment among people of power?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a combination. I mean, France is a Latin country, and the last thing they want to be like is like England, where you have tabloids that are spying on everyone's private life, and if, by God, you had a kiss with somebody who wasn't your wife or husband, you would lose your job. But obviously, this isn't about private life. If this behavior that he's reported to have done is true, I mean, this is violence, and he's reported to have done it in 2002. So journalists are now like, oh my God, are we not doing our job? What's going on? Do we need to be more like the British and Americans? And so there's a lot of soul searching going on. People are obviously seeing that some more attention does need to be paid to these things because it can bleed over into the public life. And this is very ugly what he's been accused of. And it's not at all womanizing, and it's not at all cute or manly. It's shocking.
I took particular note of a remark attributed to an unnamed aide of French President Nicolas Sarkozy that he had warned Strauss-Kahn not to get alone in an elevator with an intern. Now, if these were his marching orders for his job at the IMF, it makes me wonder how much smoke has to be visible before someone in French public life sees the fire.
Yeah, somebody should have looked into that closer. But I think whatever happens with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, I don't think the French media will ever be the same, or maybe even society. I mean, I've been here 7 years, which isn't that long, but it's by far the biggest thing that's happened since I've been here. It really is rocking society to its depths, like lifting the carpet and shining a light under there in all these dark corners.
Do you think the pendulum will swing too far to the total tabloidization of the private lives of politicians?
Nobody wants to see that kind of sleazy stuff where you're just trying to catch people in their private lives to ruin their careers. So I don't think so, but I think there's going to be some confusion at first because the journalists realize they have to do a better job. So where do they draw the new line? There's a lot of journalists who probably will dig in with relish and then some who won't. There are also strong privacy laws. You can't just print pictures of whoever you want and put them on the front of your magazine. You have to have permission. But definitely, I don't think it's going to go back to the way it was.
If this is some sort of historic inflection point in French society, it didn't seem to begin that way. The immediate reaction was a kind of anger at the American justice system.
The shock of seeing Dominique Strauss-Kahn unshaven, sweating, haggard, being led by five policemen on what's known as the perp walk. You know, and it's completely illegal in France to show pictures of someone handcuffed before they've been convicted. But TV announcers showed it and they said, we have to show you these images because it is your right to have the information. They couldn't believe it. Here was like their star politician, Frenchman on the world stage, somebody they were proud of, in like one of these American television series. It was beyond belief. But they've released the supposed victim's name here. So, you know, I keep telling them that's shocking to us. But there are still people saying, you know, the American justice system might be harsh, but look at it. This chambermaid is getting a fair trial with somebody of the likes of Dominique Strauss-Kahn. So there's less and less people angry and people realizing, well, look at his background. Maybe it did happen. Let's let the justice do its work.
There is a class aspect to all of this, right?
Yes. I mean, there's definitely an elitist class in France, which Dominique Strauss-Kahn was part of, who are above sort of everyone else and no one touches them. And then women who were affected by him, they just stayed out of his way. Nobody bothered to file a complaint or tell him to stop, you know, publicly, because he was Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
If he somehow survives the prosecution, does he have any future in French government or politics?
No one's really 100% discounted him yet, but it's just been too shocking and he's lost his allure. You know, and I think more details are going to come out. And even if he does go free, I don't see how he can really resurrect himself politically.
Eleanor, thank you very much.
Very good to be with you, Bob.
Eleanor Beardsley is NPR's correspondent in Paris. On Wednesday, President Obama signed an executive order to impose sanctions against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, punishment for his regime's crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. According to current estimates, more than 900 people have been killed in the street protests, but the regime has also been fighting activists online. As happened in Tunisia and Egypt, Syrian protesters are using sites like Facebook and Twitter to organize and to communicate. Gillian York is director of International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's been watching the cat and mouse game between Syrian activists and the regime. Gillian, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me first how the protesters are using the web.
Sure. So Syria doesn't have a very high rate of access to the internet, but people are indeed on Facebook and on Twitter, just as they were in Egypt and Tunisia previously.
One of the impulses for an autocratic regime is just to shut down the internet altogether or to impose on the ISPs to shut down access to Twitter and Facebook. Tell me how the Syrian regime has proceeded.
Syria has long blocked a number of websites. They were blocking YouTube, Blogspot, Facebook. And, you know, they block a number of political opposition sites, human rights sites, news sites as well. So Syria had been blocking all of these sites. And in February of this year, just as the protests were beginning in Syria, Syria decided that they would unblock Blogspot, YouTube, and Facebook. My immediate reaction was, wow, they're going to be using this for surveillance. I mean, that's the only reason that I can think of. As it turns out, they really did use it for surveillance.
It was a sort of fishing expedition on a grand scale, no?
The authorities first started arresting activists and even some non-activists, demanding their Facebook passwords, and then presumably using their accounts to spy on their contacts unknowingly. So that was the first thing that they did. But then more recently, we discovered that someone, we assume the Syrian telecom ministry, but we can't confirm, of course, when Syrians were going to Facebook using HTTPS, a more encrypted version of Facebook, they were presented with a certificate that most people would just click right through. But as it turns out, this was actually a fake certificate and allowed someone to spy on everything that you were doing once you logged into Facebook.
And what did the Syrian intelligence agencies glean?
Anything that you keep private, all of your contacts, your password, your secret question that you put in to regain your password if you've lost it, all of that would then become available to somebody conducting such an attack.
Pro-Assad forces did something kind of ingenious on Twitter as well. One of the things they're doing is to employ a hashtag.
A hashtag is when you use the hash mark with a chosen word or phrase or numbers that refer to something intentionally so that when a person searches on Twitter for that hashtag, they can find news about a certain subject. And so in Syria, people have mainly been using just the hashtag Syria. People, you know, probably pro-regime, perhaps affiliated with the regime, went on Twitter and created these automated bots that would then tweet information using the Syria hashtag. And what these feeds were sending was, you know, photos of Syria, just a picture of scenery, for example, with the Syria hashtag. And the purpose of this is to flood that hashtag so that when someone is trying to search for information about Syria, instead of coming across photos and videos from protests, they come across these, you know, banal images.
Not a denial of service attack, sort of a denial of substance attack.
Right, right.
Tell me what, if anything, the American companies that operate these platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, are doing to facilitate the protesters in their fight against repression.
I think this is a really tricky question for a lot of American companies, and it's one that I understand, but that still frustrates me, which is, to what extent should they take sides? You know, with Facebook, they've really been cautious, as far as I can tell, to stay away from being associated with protest. I think that there's some good reason if they're trying to get into China. If they become a tool for revolution, China's going to say no way. You know, at the same time, they've reacted to what was happening in Tunisia by rolling out HTTPS and making sure that Tunisian users change their passwords. You know, I haven't really seen them doing anything in response to Syria. Hopefully we'll make them see that this is also a pretty serious security concern. But in the meantime, you know, I would just tell Syrians not to use Facebook for protest.
All right. So you're suggesting that it's dangerous to use Facebook as a tool of the uprising. Then what? If not Facebook, what?
I mean, I think that's the valid question. I mean, part of the issue with Facebook is that their policy requires that users use their real name. But then again, if they're using their real names, they're at risk of being, detained, arrested, or worse.
The world has stood in awe of the Arab Spring. But as protesters learned techniques for coalescing crowds and so on, regimes also had the opportunity to see what works and doesn't work. What has Assad learned?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's a really great question. If you look at Tunisia and Egypt, you've got this sort of dictator's dilemma issue where, you know, in Tunisia, they went in one direction by not blocking these websites. Ben Ali even tried to make a concession in his last speech to free the internet. Whereas in Egypt, they went in the opposite direction and blocked websites and then shut down the internet, of course. Syria has taken a completely different approach by unblocking websites and then using them to potentially spy on citizens. I think that they could target mobile networks in Syria, and that would be a huge harm to the protests there.
Jillian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jillian York is Director of International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. And REI. REI has provided gear and advice to inspire, educate, and outfit for a lifetime of outdoor adventure and stewardship. Information in stores and at REI.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this year, Comcast, the largest cable operator in the U.S., merged with NBC Universal, one of the nation's largest content providers. After a lengthy review, the FCC approved the deal by a 4-to-1 margin. Last week, one of the FCC commissioners who voted yes on the merger, Meredith Baker, a Republican, announced that she's quitting to work in the private sector. For Comcast. It's the kind of story that, at least on the surface, looks really, really bad. Timothy Carney is a senior political columnist for the Washington Examiner who spent a lot of time covering the so-called revolving door between government and industry. He believes the media often exhibit a double standard when it comes to these cases.
This case, the Meredith Baker case, is getting more attention than many other revolving door cases. And I think it's because she is a believer in the free market. I think the media often gloss over it when there is a revolving door case involving a big government politician or a big government bureaucrat who then cashes out to the companies that he or she were regulating.
There have been some congressmen who passed Obama's health care bill who later became health care lobbyists, and you feel like the media have not made nearly as big a deal over people like that.
Former Congressman Bart Stupak was the single most important rank-and-file congressman in passing the health care bill. Bart Stupak was known as a pro-life Democrat, yet he put a stamp of approval on the bill, thus being crucial to its passage. And then he knew he couldn't win re-election, presumably, and when his term in Congress was up, became a lobbyist at a firm that represents healthcare companies. When he was hired, the letter that the firm sent out said, "Please see the news below that former Congressman Bart Stupak, who played a lead role in passage of the landmark healthcare legislation, has joined Venable LLP. I see here another conflict of interest where there's an incentive to increase government control over industries so that there's a more demand for lobbyists and consultants that come from inside the government."
Isn't that a more complicated explanation than simply they believe that more government involvement is socially better? I mean, it's an idea that you don't agree with, but that, you know, that's their motivation?
Would you accept the explanation that Meredith Baker, in ruling on Comcast, was doing what she thought was best for the country and following what she thought was the FCC's proper role by staying out of the situation?
I actually would. It's entirely consistent with the policies that she's always supported. So, yeah.
That is a good distinction. And that's one that I always try to look at is there evidence that these people are acting according to principle of what they think is best? Or does it look like they made certain exceptions to what they think is best? I think that a tendency of the media is to give more leeway to those who believe in big government and less leeway to those who believe in the free market. Because I think there's a misperception in much of the media. Big business is just as likely to benefit from government growing as it is to benefit from government shrinking.
Given the problems that are posed by this revolving door, the Obama administration asked FCC commissioners to sign an ethics pledge that would prohibit them from lobbying anyone at the FCC for 2 years, but they can immediately begin to lobby members of Congress. So how good is this pledge?
And if you look at they call them the cooling off periods, 2 years, retired congressman can lobby the Senate the first day after he leaves the House, and he can lobby the president that same day. He just can't lobby the House until 2 years later. So the Obama ethics pledge matches the existing law on that sort of thing. And it also doesn't keep these people from just becoming consultants. There's no guarantee that Meredith Baker is going to be lobbying anyone ever. She might just be helping Comcast steer through future FCC issues, just like Amy Friend, chief counsel of the Senate Banking Committee, who helped write the Dodd-Frank bill. She will be helping financial institutions work on the implementation of the bill. That might mean lobbying the regulators, or it might just mean telling them how to lobby.
So what do you think the media's role ought to be?
I try to mention every time a government employee is leaving to the private sector in a way where he will be, as I put it, monetizing his public service, showing the occasion of sin, as we Catholics might put it, showing the appearance of impropriety, the possibility of bad motives, I think will impose a bit of a social cost on cashing out. Maybe we can shame some people to look for post-government employment that is not turning their public service to the benefit of a special interest.
Timothy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Timothy Carney is a senior political columnist for the Washington Examiner. The past 2 weeks have been good for Microsoft. Not only did the company acquire Skype, the multi-billion-dollar internet voice communication company, it also bid adieu to its Committee of Federally Appointed Chaperones. The committee was created in the wake of the government's antitrust case against Microsoft back in 1997. Its job was to make sure Microsoft stayed in compliance with U.S. antitrust laws. Many people have argued that Microsoft should be split into two parts. One would just oversee Microsoft's Windows operating system and the applications programmed for it, Microsoft Office, Microsoft Word. The other would strictly oversee Internet Explorer, the company's web browser. Instead, Microsoft was allowed to remain intact. Now, as the company's panel of overseers go gently into that good night, we wondered, did any of this matter? Did it make any difference? We asked Tim Wu, author of The Master Switch and advisor to the Federal Trade Commission.
The Justice Department was right to bring the case. I speak for myself, not my employer, the FTC. I strongly feel this was the right decision. Personally, and speaking again only for myself, I think they should have broke the company into two pieces, the operating system and the applications, and we would have seen a lot more innovation, things like competitors to Word and PowerPoint and Excel that actually had some chance of success.
But Larry Seltzer, who's a contributing editor at PC Magazine, notes, and I'm quoting him now, "Everyone who ever bought a Microsoft product had alternatives. They chose to buy the Microsoft product. The products sucked, but all things considered, they were better than the alternatives."
If we agree that Windows was the best, even if it sucked, the problem wasn't so much Microsoft's attaining of a monopoly, which is legal. It was the use of its monopoly power subsequently to try to destroy competitors in the browser market, which is a very different issue.
Meanwhile, browsers are free, and one of the most popular ones, Mozilla's Firefox, is actually open source. Users can work on it, not just corporate developers. So why do you think government intervention was even necessary?
Microsoft was not allowed to monopolize the browser market. Google, Facebook, maybe Wikipedia, Skype, all the internet companies of the noughts and of the 1990s might have become Microsoft's latest victims. I believe the fate of Google would have been, and of Facebook, would have been very similar to the fate of WordPerfect and Lotus 1-2-3. Very powerful companies, arguably with the best products in their class, that were all trounced by Microsoft, not on the merits, but because of the control of the platform. Microsoft had a repeated pattern where it would set up a platform, invite everyone in, copy the most successful products with their own product, and then make sure that they won the competition. And I think we avoided that fate, making the Justice Department's case ultimately justified.
To bring up Larry Seltzer one last time, he says that the computer industry changed because of the free enterprise that was always there and not because the government stepped in and made things better.
If you knew that starting a company like Facebook was suicide because Microsoft would copy you and eliminate you off their browser, it would have been a very different market. And so I think the last 10 or 11 years of development on the web was partially because no one owned the web, no one can control the web, no one had the, shall we say, the master switch over who won and lost on that network.
Clever interpolation of the title of your book, but let's bring up the master switch again.
Sure.
Could it happen again? Could it be once again in the thrall of one great company that will smother the development of competitors?
History tends to repeat itself, and given a chance, men and women tend to dream of glory and empire. That's why I think that the attitude that, you know, antitrust law is a sort of a matter of the past is to neglect the fundamentals of human nature. I imagine our future will be like our past.
So you think that this panel of overseers actually worked?
What I think was important was Microsoft knowing that it was under watch. People behave differently with a policeman at the elbow. I mean, the most obvious thing that Microsoft could have done was to create Explorer in a way that favored its own search and disadvantaged Google. But I think they sensed that if they started to try to mess with the search engine market through their browser, that next thing you knew, the antitrust authorities would be on them again. Sometimes the most important thing a government can do with a dominant monopolist is to just let them know that they're being watched.
Yeah, thank God we had the Securities and Exchange Commission keeping its eye on Wall Street.
That was a different set of problems. I don't want to comment on the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Tim, thank you very much.
Always a great pleasure.
Tim Wu is senior advisor to the FTC and author of the book, The Master Switch. Does the internet cocoon us with like-minded people, or do the hours we spend online expose us to more points of view? In his new book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You, author Eli Pariser contends that the internet is actually forcing us into echo chambers, that it looks at our Google searches, our emails, our Facebook posts, studies the links that we click on, and decides what we want to know. Even a small search yields different results for different people, says Pariser, as when two people he knows searched BP during the oil spill.
And one person saw information about the oil spill, what you can do about it, the environmental consequences. And another person saw stock tips. Here's how the BP stock is doing. Here's investment information. You know, this could lead to some pretty bad decisions. And the thing is that it's not just Google that is doing this now. You know, it's happening on Facebook. It's happening on Yahoo News. And increasingly, it's happening on the front of major newspapers. The New York Times now has a recommended for you section that employs these same kinds of algorithms.
Google was supposed to be the ultimate democratizing source of information, elected by the world.
Right. And if you look at Larry Page, one of the Google founders, and what he writes about the PageRank algorithm that Google started with, it was explicitly this kind of democratic project. Let's have the web vote for which page is the right page. And Google's really moved away from that, and they've moved toward this kind of personalized, user behavior-driven way of presenting information, which is pretty good if you're searching for pizza. But when Google is the way that a lot of people experience information and news, you know, I think it's a bigger problem.
Now, you're a former director of MoveOn.org. You're a liberal, and you've noticed that your conservative friends have sort of been disappeared from your Facebook news feed, right? I have two questions. First of all, you have conservative friends? And second of all, they've been disappeared?
I actually went out of my way to like meet and befriend and Facebook friend people who I thought were interesting, who had really different viewpoints. And then I logged on one day and I noticed that, oh, you know, I haven't seen any of these people in a really long time. And what Facebook was doing was essentially looking at who I was actually clicking on and which links I was actually clicking. And they were saying, yeah, you know, we know you say you're interested in these people, but actually, we know you're interested in the more progressive links and, frankly, like the entertaining stuff. We know you want to see videos of cats. And so, you know.
And do you?
And I do, yeah. And I still click on them, I'll admit.
Now, how in general does Facebook work to keep us on Facebook?
For example, they know that if you're a 30-something woman and you see that your female friends have uploaded pictures of themselves, you're likely to upload a picture of yourself in the next month. And they know that if you do that, that your male friends are very likely to comment on that picture. And they know that if your male friends comment on that picture, they're likely to stay on Facebook for months to come. And so what Facebook does, according to one person I talked to there, is they actually kind of run that in reverse. They say, oh, this guy looks like he's kind of getting bored of Facebook. Let's find one of his friends, show her pictures of her friends that they've uploaded so that she uploads a photo, so that he comments on it, so that he stays on Facebook more.
Diabolical. Now, none of this personalization would have been possible if we were completely anonymous online. And you note in your book that there is a greater and greater tendency towards less anonymity.
There's this race going on to compile the most complete profile of each person possible. You know, Axiom, the sort of 800-pound gorilla in that industry, has about 1,500 points of data on each person. They had more data on the 9/11 hijackers on September 12th than the FBI did. And they're mostly just trying to provide companies with data that they can use to do these kinds of targeted mailings. But increasingly, the same kind of data is being used to personalize what you see and the content that you see.
This is really, really bizarre. You recently got a friend request from an attractive young woman who didn't exist.
That's right. I was looking at my Facebook friend requests, and there was this woman who, you know, sort of a buxom young woman in the little icon, and I clicked on it, I'll admit, and I realized that there was something weird with her face. It took me a minute to realize that it was actually a computer-generated image that had been generated by a company that was basically trying to use these essentially people who were ads, avatars, to get my personal information. As the filter bubble gets stronger and stronger, and it's harder for companies to just blanket and broadcast with their products, you're going to see them building little code robots to run around, befriend people, and then try to get them to give data. This is the future that we're walking into.
So, Eli, what should we do? What should internet companies do?
Well, I think for the companies, we need to call on them to really get serious about taking responsibility for this enormous amount of power that they have. They like to pretend, you know, that they're just doing our bidding, their tools, nothing to see here. That was kind of cute when they were insurgents and Mark Zuckerberg was 22, and now that he's 26, and Facebook is, he has to take some responsibility. You know, what that means is building algorithms that don't just show you the things that you click on the most, but that show you the things that we need our media to show us, which is the things that are important.
You're asking Facebook to social engineer our view of the world.
Facebook already does social engineer our view of the world. It just does it based on one very narrow variable, which is likes. Facebook can make a choice, and they can choose to either kind of give us sort of a likeful, happy, positive Facebook world, or they can actually step up and say, we're providing information to, at this point, nearly a billion people, and we need to take that seriously. For example, you could have Facebook add an important button. So you'd have like and you'd have important. And what shows up in the newsfeed is some mix of those two things.
And dislike?
And dislike. You know, that would be great. The quote that really got me thinking about this with Mark Zuckerberg was, he said, a squirrel dying in your front yard may have more relevance to your interests right now than people dying in Africa. And that's true, but if all you're showing people is a squirrel, you know, you're going to have a real problem as a society.
Eli, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Eli Pariser is the author of The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You.
Coming up, one good thing about the movies is no commercials. Yes, there are.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Week and offering live seminars across the country. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them, on newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
Just a reminder, podcast listeners, we really, really need you to help us support this podcast. So please text OTM to 25383 and send us $10. Messaging and data rates apply. It'll appear on your phone bill. Thank you very much. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're all accustomed to product placement in TV shows and movies. Sometimes it's obvious and clumsy, sometimes seamless and smooth, and sometimes it actually adds to the verisimilitude of a scene. But nowadays, as filmmaker Morgan Spurlock documents in his new movie, product placement is just the beginning. It's all about co-promotion. Corporates speak for when a movie partners with a bunch of brands to flood the world with messages about both the product and the new film. For example, everywhere you look, there's Shrek flogging a Royal Caribbean cruise or Iron Man selling Diet Dr. Pepper. In his film, Spurlock decided to test a premise.
But do all these co-promotions actually work? Do they have that much influence over the choices we make? Does Shrek make me want to take a Royal Caribbean cruise or Burger King make me want to go see Twilight? Is the only thing missing from my movie achieving Iron Man status a little co-promotion? Well, if that's true, then I can't wait to get some of that sweet Hollywood ad money.
And he did. He made an expose about product placement and co-promotion, financed entirely by product placement and co-promotion. He approached 600 brands and in the end convinced 22 of them to fund his film called Palm Wonderful Presents the Greatest Movie Ever Sold. In the process, he confronted the many compromises filmmakers must make to get at that sweet Hollywood ad money. Full disclosure, I was actually in this film for like 6 seconds. Sadly, no money changed hands. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Probably the greatest 6 seconds I've ever seen on film.
Yeah. This movie is so meta. You've constructed like all these not quite opposing mirrors.
And it's hard to know where you stand in all of it, because on the one hand, you're...
On one hand, I'm critiquing it. On the other hand, I'm taking the money.
Yeah, I'm getting to that. I'm just trying to think of a word.
Whore. sellout.
You did keep the money, right?
Of course. We made the movie with their money. You know, over the course of the film, you see everything that we're critiquing at the beginning are all the same tools that we start to implement and institute at the end to promote the movie and get it out into the public. So hopefully that, you know, that full circle kind of satire isn't lost when people see it. And they see that all the mechanisms are what actually got them into the theater to begin with.
Was there any business that you just refused to do?
I tried everyone. I called gun manufacturers. You know, I wanted to get the greatest rifle you'll ever use. No gun companies would come on board. We called cigarette companies because I wanted to try to have a real ethical conversation of, you know, there are companies that you shouldn't have sponsoring your projects. I even called BP. Like, I called BP and I said, you know, you guys could be the official gas sponsor. I promise we won't say the greatest oil ever spilled. We'll say something else. They didn't want to play along.
They know who you are. They know that there's a high percentage possibility that one way or another they're going to be the butt of a joke.
Their products won't be the butt of the joke.
Yeah. I mean, there's this one scene in which you have the brand stewards of Ban deodorant in a room. You ask them, you know, what does their product stand for? And this is what it sounded like.
What are the words that you would use to describe Ban? Ban is blank.
That's a great question.
I actually got a tweet from someone yesterday who said I was walking through the pharmacy in my hometown and saw Ban deodorant, hadn't thought of it in years since I saw your movie, so I bought some. So there it is. The power of product placement worked. Wow. Even out of this documentary.
One of the celebrities who shows up in your movie is Ralph Nader.
Yes.
He's celebrated principally for being a consumer advocate in addition to being a presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He's made a career of calling the society's attention to the difference between an advertising promise and reality. And he cheerfully plays along. He even accepts a free pair of shoes.
Yes, he does.
Absolutely. And this is a fantastic shoe.
What is it?
This is a Merrell.
Merrell?
Merrells, yeah.
Is it new?
They've been out a few years. Like, I've had a pair of these before, and so we called them because I'm a fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's the arch support?
It's great.
Well, I gave him a pair of slip-on Merrells first, and then when I went to a screening in D.C. and saw him, he comes down, he and I are doing the Q&A together, and he goes, what, you couldn't send me a pair of shoes with laces? And so I said, on it, you know, don't worry. So the next day I made sure he got a pair of shoes with laces.
Wow. You heard it here first. We've talked about the commercial products that were on board. One of your partners was a school district in Florida. Tell me about them.
Yeah, you know, we started doing a lot of research into school districts across the country now that are cash strapped, that are trying to, you know, bridge budget gaps as they continue to have money taken away by their states and local municipalities. And, you know, we said we should go talk to one of these schools, you know, one of these districts that now is letting advertising in, you know, and they're advertising now on school buses, you know, in gymnasiums. They're selling naming rights to whether it be stadiums or gymnasiums or other rooms within facilities. Broward County was one of those. And this is only one district in countless states where this is happening. You know, there's dozens of states that are doing the same thing right now.
You could have portrayed this as a poignant situation or repulsive. You decided not to take these people down.
Ultimately, we wanted to advertise in the school district. We could make a larger point by putting our ads on the buses and on the mail trucks and on the fences and on murals and within the school district. I mean, listen, they don't want to be taking advertising. They don't want to have to deal with that. But what choice do they have? And that's their point of view. It's like, well, what are we supposed to do? There's a great interview with a classroom, you know, as we go to talk to these school districts. And this one girl says something I think is so fantastic, which is, we have enough advertising in the world. Do I really need to go to Red Bull High? And, you know, the way I look at it is, yeah, it won't be long till I'm taking my 5-year-old, you know, dropping him off for his first day of high school at Red Bull High.
Throughout the whole movie, you are cheerfully trying to forge partnerships to build these brands and to build your film.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been points when you just wanted to actually jump out and start lecturing either the people you were in the room with or the audience about just how phenomenally sleazy this can be.
Yeah. You start to feel dirty when you're going into the rooms and you're so beholden to them at that point because, you know, you need their money and you need these things to finish the film. So there is like that. That's where the dark side does start to creep in, as you start having to kind of play the game. You know, you can't think that there's not going to be a compromise once you start working with these companies or taking their money or their products. And you have to find that middle ground. And so it's when they're expecting you to kind of literally turn every conversation you have into a commercial that you're like, this is ridiculous. You know, there's no way I'm doing any of this. And that's what you see happening in film and TV.
And what's the best kind of shoes if I needed some shoes?
I mean, if I was going to go out and get a pair of shoes, I mean, I would probably get a comfortable pair of Merrells. They are probably the greatest shoe you'll ever wear.
Morgan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Morgan Spurlock is the star and creator of Palm Wonderful Presents the Greatest Movie Ever Sold.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law.
That clip you just heard was actor David Strathairn playing CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow standing up to McCarthyism in the 2005 film Good Night and Good Luck. Joe and Shirley Wershbaugh were also at CBS then. In fact, it was Joe who in 1953 interviewed Lieutenant Radulovich, kicked out of the Air Force Reserve because his father, an immigrant from Serbia, subscribed to foreign newspapers and because his sister was an avowed liberal. The New York Times noted that it was the first salvo fired by the network against Senator Joe McCarthy. Joe Wershbaugh died last Saturday at the age of 90. We spoke to Joe and Shirley about the film, in which they were played by Robert Downey Jr. and Patricia Clarkson, and about the bygone days of smoke-filled newsrooms and courage on the air. We decided to re-air that interview in honor of Joe. The couple agreed that the film's depiction of Murrow was uncanny.
It was unbelievable.
I'll tell you how unbelievable it was. When I first saw Strathairn, I saw him from the back of his head, and I said, my God, it's Murrow's head. And the minute he opened his mouth and looked towards us, it was Murrow all over again. He didn't try to imitate Murrow. He exuded Murrow.
George Clooney plays the legendary Fred Friendly as a relatively quiet, wry person. He was Murrow's producer. He also functioned in some degree, it seems, as his heat shield.
Fred Friendly was the enforcer. Murrow came up with what he wanted to do with the line that he was taking. And Fred saw to it that all the stuff that we had was edited with that in mind. If anybody ever terrorized people, it was Fred.
I think he wanted Murrow to have all of the attention.
One thing I noticed was that during Murrow's broadcasts, we see Fred Friendly literally crouched at his feet, obscured partly by his desk, and he cued Murrow by tapping a pen on Murrow's knee. And he lit Murrow's cigarettes during the taped segments, speaking quietly, still crouched there. Was that what it was really like?
Yes, exactly. That was the way he cued Murrow to start, because they were in very, very tight quarters. As a matter of fact, some of the people who saw a screening of it, people like Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather and Morley Safer and Walter Cronkite, they said they have never seen a newsroom film that was as authentic as this.
Cigarette smoke seems to fill nearly every frame, mostly coming from Murrow's cigarette.
Everybody smoked in those days. I smoked. Joe smoked.
At a time when we went to Korea to cover the Korean War in 52, Ed and I shared a room, and at 4:30 in the morning I would hear a zip, and that was Murrow starting his morning with a cigarette. He was doing a minimum of 2 packs a day, but I think he went up to 4 packs a day.
Yeah, he always had a cigarette.
And he just couldn't be talked out of it until he developed lung disease later on.
And he died of lung cancer in 1964.
Yes, he did. The interesting thing about the crew of actors in the scene is that I don't think any of them smoke. And here they had to. But I know they were not inhaling. They were just puffing it out. And when George Clooney learned from Ruth Friendly that Fred Friendly had never smoked, he was so relieved because he's not a smoker. He didn't have to smoke, but everybody else did.
I want to move to the political environment now, and I'm talking about politics with a big P and politics with a small p. In terms of office politics, there was a rule that professional colleagues at CBS weren't allowed to marry.
You weren't allowed to be in the company if you had a relative there, whether it was a cousin, an uncle, a sister, and certainly you couldn't be married.
Well, what's a fancy word for that kind of a situation?
Nepotism.
Well, that was supposed to be nepotism at $45 a week, and it was a big word to spread over $45.
We knew that one of us would have to quit. As a matter of fact, the boss at the time said he thought that we ought to get married, and I said, well, we would, except I don't want to quit working. So he said, well, don't tell anybody about it. I'll try to clear it with personnel, which he never did, so we had to keep it a secret.
So did you really take off your wedding rings before you went to work?
Absolutely. Joe actually didn't wear one. But I put it on a gold chain around my neck, and I always had high neck blouses.
Let me move on to William Paley. He ran the CBS network for what, about 50 years?
Well, he started it.
He's depicted by Frank Langella as a figure who is as huge and immovable as the Washington Monument. What role did he play in the real-life drama?
Bill Paley created the Columbia Broadcasting System. He backed the best news and news people that he could find. Murrow was his boy.
And his friend.
And his friend. It was a rarity for anybody to be Bill Paley's friend who wasn't a member of the family.
Okay, but we see in the film a rather testy exchange between Murrow and Paley.
It got to that stage only because Murrow and Friendly were not going to quit cold on the stories that they did. Paley knew that they weren't going to quit, and I thought that it was a fair shake that somebody should know that going on the air with an attack on McCarthy, this was breaking the rule which Paley and Murrow themselves had set up, which could lead to closing down the whole news business.
Somebody's going to go down. Have you checked your facts? Are you sure you're on safe ground?
Bill, it's time. Show our cards.
My cards. You lose, what happens? Five guys find themselves out of work. I'm responsible for a hell of a lot more than five goddamn reporters. Let it go.
You could tell that a lot of the people were worried stiff about what the consequences of this program would be, and Murrow caught that and said, Terra is right here in this room. And then he followed up with another line, which unfortunately is not in the script, but I remember it, and I couldn't have made it up myself. No one man can terrorize a whole nation unless we are all his accomplices.
You know, in the end, it wasn't politics, but bottom line pressures that compelled Paley to act and essentially push Murrow off of his primetime perch.
Well, you know, Paley, I think he once said his sorriest day was when he went public with the company, because then he had to answer to the economic pressures that would come from shareholders. You had to turn a profit. I think Paley, given his druthers, would have gone along with Murrow all the way.
You know, you two have in the film an exchange in bed one night. Mm. It's of such critical dramatic significance, I kind of thought it was added by the writers. Joe, you sort of muse, what if we meaning Murrow's boys, are wrong? What if there are communists out there poised to take down our government? And you said, what if we're protecting the wrong people? Did that exchange happen?
Not really. We talked about not so much were we wrong, but were we doing the right thing? Because we grew up in this atmosphere of you don't take sides. You just present the news straight. That was the discussion that Joe and I used to have. Should we break with it? And I can remember that thought in particular. You've got to do it. You've got to go with this program, or else what happens to the country? Also, he did offer McCarthy equal time to answer.
Some say that the wise, deadpan news anchor of old is passing out of time. Some of them see this as the model of the Murrow tradition, but actually, if you look at the film, Murrow wasn't the very model of the objective, opinion-free anchor. His legend is built on when he took a stand. Nowadays, that would be seen as questionable journalism, and I don't think he'd last long in the anchor chair.
Well, he wouldn't be doing it every night or every week. It was on very, very special occasions. If you recall, Walter Cronkite stepped out behind that wall of impartiality when he said the Vietnam War was unwinnable. On rare occasions, if someone you respect who has been impartial, if he or she should say, there is only one side here. I will give it to you. And then it's up to your audience to make the decision.
I must tell you that Murrow agonized over what right did he have to use the whole power of a network to go against one man. And the answer to that is, he, that man, is strong enough to take care of himself. And that's where that line from Shakespeare comes in.
Earlier the senator asked, upon what meat does this our Caesar feed? Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating, but the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly.
Right after he came out of the studio, having done the McCarthy broadcast, I knew I was going to be having children, and I said, Ed, if it's a boy, I'm going to name him after you. And he answered, do you think it was worth it? And I said, it has to be.
Did you name your child after him?
I did.
So you guys didn't take your work home.
We lived our work.
Yeah. Joe Wershba died last week at the age of 90.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.